On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The three climbers on the Tilly Jane Trailhead, December 8th, beneath Oregon's towering Mount Hood, left behind a simple note at the warming hut at the ranger station. "We are a party of three attempting North Face," they wrote, and that was it. Up they went to the summit, it appears, never to come down. There were 100-mile-an-hour winds, intense storms, 10 feet of snow. On Sunday, the body of James Kelly, 48, was found in a snow cave on the mountain after a desperate cell phone call. A fleet of aircraft, search and rescue volunteers, the National Guard, all called out to find his mates. Yesterday, the searchers surrendered. Up next on Point, we go to Mount Hood and then ask great climbers, despite it all, why they climb. We will talk in this hour with Phil and Susan Ursler, the first married couple to climb all the fabled seven summits, the highest peaks on seven continents. And we'll hear from climber and writer Clint Willis on the cult of extreme climbing that grew around Everest. But first today, we turn to Oregon and Mount Hood country. Christian Foden-Wenzel is at Oregon Public Radio in Portland. He's covered the search and rescue operation on Mount Hood for the last 10 days. The search called off last night. Christian, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. My pleasure.
Lots of people have been following this closely, but remind us of the details. Who were these three men? What was their background? And what do we know about how they got in trouble on Mount Hood?
Yeah, well, apparently these three guys, two of them from Dallas. One is a landscape architect, Kelly James. The other one was an athletic trainer. And the third one was a lawyer from New York. And apparently, I think they met maybe a year or so ago on Mount Rainier, which is up in Washington.
Sure.
Here, and made good friends, started climbing, that kind of thing. And they arrived here to try and hone their skills on Mount Hood during bad weather, basically. So.
36, 37 years old, 48 years old, Kelly James.
Yeah.
Experienced climbers. How did they approach Mount Hood? Was it the standard way? Was it just the time of year that made this different, that made it dangerous?
No, I think what they did was they tried to do a very quick climb, up and down in 2 days. This is my understanding. They did most of the things right. They turned up in their car, they left notes and registered with climbing offices, even though in one point there was no forms to register. They got out a note, they knew what to do, and they went up there to do things quickly. So I think, you know, and we heard from the family over and over again that these guys were very experienced. In one note they left, they said they'd climbed Denali and Mount Rainier and other mountains down in South America. So I think a lot of people have had a lot of faith that these guys would be fine and that they could survive many days on a mountain in snow caves and things like that.
So December 8th, they set out for what was supposed to be a two-day climb. December 10th, 2 days later, James Kelly calls his family on his cell phone and says they're in trouble. What is known, if anything, about what happened then? What's been pieced together?
Yeah, well, basically, this phone call lasted for about 4 minutes, and it was the last phone call we had. We did have a ping off the cell phone later, but we think maybe that was from the battery dying. And he had told his family that he was up in the cave and that he'd hinted that he was injured. He said, "I'm a little weak, not feeling that good." But he didn't actually say that, so people thought, well, he said, okay, we'll go up and get them. But what sounds like happened is these guys managed to get up a pretty difficult area of the mountain. They got to the top, and something happened. We don't know what. We do know that he had a dislocated shoulder, but x-rays and things like that later on, after they found Kelly James's body, show that, you know, nothing was broken, those kind of things. So it was a pretty, not a terrible injury, let's say. So they hold him up in a snow cave, and I think the snow cave was big enough for three of them, so maybe they spent a night there, and then the weather came in, and I think at that point, and this is all speculation, obviously, they thought, well, what can we do? You know, and the other two guys set off to try and make a route back down. And one of the things that Kelly James told his family on the phone was that the way that they had come was impossible to get back down. And the routes on the top, some of the markings for the footprints left, show that these guys did walk around and look around to see another way, see if there was an easier way down. But what they think they happened was they ended up back at the top of where they'd come up, and there was a certain Y shape in the ropes that they found that they thought meant, yes, I'm here, but apparently that may have been an anchor for them to lower themselves down, and they think maybe an avalanche or a fall or something like that, and that's why they've called off the changed from a rescue effort to a search effort now to a recovery effort.
A recovery effort. It was a huge search and rescue effort that went on before it was called off. Give us a sense of the dimension from the aircraft to search and rescue to the National Guard.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was probably about 100 people up on the mountain on the busiest day, which is, I think, was a Sunday, where we had really beautiful, clear weather and no wind. But that does make it sound like there's 100 searches. There were not 100 searches. There were 100 people up there organizing communications, flying helicopters, doing other things. There's several, I mean, I'm not 100% sure, but I would say maybe 40 searches, something like that. We're actually on the mountain walking around, that kind of thing. But most of these people were volunteers. Although they're with the National Guard and with various climbing groups, they are volunteers. But also it's regarded by some in the National Guard as a way to get some training. You get out there, get into extreme situations, and that's very good training.
And Christian, what about Oregonians? How are they taking this on board? Here, glad to try and help out the climbers, or what are these guys doing imposing on the whole state, you know, for their wacky winter mission?
Well, no, I think most people are pretty sympathetic.
Mm-hmm.
We had a case, and people may have heard it a few weeks earlier than this, with James Kim. It's a family and his family who had driven through southern Oregon and taken a turn out to the coast and ended up, you know, stranded. He died.
I think the whole world knows that story, but then, of course, he was just on flat land, more or less, not mountain climbing exactly.
Yeah, and it certainly wasn't mountain climbing, but there was small mountains involved and a little snow, but I think that caught people's imagination. And then we had the climbers up here, which was like, what's happening in Oregon? Don't go because you'll get lost, you know, that kind of thing. So,
yeah.
But I haven't heard too much, too many people complaining. What I do know is that it cost the sheriff's office $5,000 a day to run its search operation, and it has an annual budget of $14,000. So I think, there are going to be some financial issues, but they're not massive because, like I said, a lot of this is
volunteering.
Volunteer work,
We're going to turn to one of those who was involved in the search and rescue mission, Christian Fodenvenzel. We're very grateful to you for your time. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Christian Fodenvenzel of Oregon Public Radio in Portland. We're joined now by Joe Owens, also in Portland, Oregon. Joe is with Portland Mountain Rescue. He took part in the search this week for climbers Kelly James, Brian Hall, and Jerry Nico Cook. On Monday, Joe and a fellow rescuer discovered James' body in a snow cave on the mountain. Joe Owens, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
Describe the scene when you finally found Kelly James' body. Where were you? What was the cave? What was the scenario?
Well, on Saturday we actually saw some what looked like a rope on the Cooper 4 side of the mountain, and on Saturday evening. So Sunday we went up in another helicopter just to confirm what we saw and also to evaluate the conditions. We later then got what's called a summit insertion team, where the Chinook helicopter was able to hover about 100 feet from the summit and land some rescue people. We then set up snow anchors, and we had 600 foot of rope, and we lowered climbers to the original rope that was found, and there was a small cave there. We also noticed that there was footprints going from that location up towards the mountain to confirm that they had been on the summit. And then once on the summit, we saw there was other fainter snow prints heading off in a more eastern direction. And basically then you had two sets of footprints divided by maybe about 1,000 horizontal feet. And we just tried to join the two footprints by walking on the slope and probing the slope. And the snow cave, when we found it, wasn't visible from the air. It wasn't visible even by walking on the slope. It had been covered by snow. Any ones or any kind of markings that they may have put out on the snow cave were either covered by the recent snowfall or had been blown off by the winds. So we actually found it by probing. And by probing, you feel a little bit less resistance when the probe hits a hole. And the hole was made bigger and bigger, and then suddenly we realized it's a cave. And unfortunately, when we excavated more, we saw James inside. He was lying down in a fetal position.
Had you had any hope of finding him alive at that point when you found the cave? Did you for a moment think, perhaps they're alive, someone's alive in there?
Really, judging by the slope itself, when the snow cave was covered over, there'd be no air getting into the cave. And it showed that the person inside wasn't maintaining an airway. It was a clear day, so he wasn't trying to put any markers outside the cave. But it's also possible that when you're very, very cold, the whole body process slows down, and you can go into a pretty coma-like state and still be alive. So we had hope until we actually did various medical tests on
Mr. Owens, we've just got half a minute here. You found this body. You're a climber yourself. Here you've seen the death that can come from it firsthand. Do you still understand climbing? Do you still understand why people do it despite that?
Well, you know, climbing changes people. After you summit a mountain, the experience changes you. You push yourself physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, and you learn something about that experience. And, you know, people who are passionate about the mountain, they find that passion, and then they bring it down from the mountain, and they spread it throughout the rest of their lives.
Joe Owens, thank you very much for being with us. We're going to speak in a few minutes with a couple of the country's top mountain climbers, a husband and wife team, Phil and Sue Erschler. Will join us from Washington State. But right now from Portland, Maine, Clint Willis is with us. He's a climber himself since very early on, author. He's written hundreds of articles for Men's Journal, Outside Magazine, The New York Times. His new book is The Boys of Everest, Chris Bonington, and The Tragedy of Climbing's Greatest Generation. Clint Willis, thank you very much for being with us.
Glad to be here, Tom.
You've looked at some of the sort of wildest, biggest risk takers in mountain climbing's history. So I'm not saying this trio on Mount Hood were in that class, but you understand well why climbers do it. Began to take us into the mentality. It's had an incredible magnetism for a long, long time, even after we've gone right off the planet. Take us to it. Why?
Well, you know, I opened the book with a quote from a guy named Robert McFarlane, who wrote a book called Mountains of the Mind. He says, those who travel to mountaintops are half in love with themselves and half in love with oblivion. And that quote really spoke to me after working with the stories of these climbers for several years and also interviewing the surviving climbers and the survivors of the climbers who didn't make it through the story. I think what McFarlane means is that when you get to the top of a mountain, you get to say to yourself, look at me, I'm a big shot. I look down on everything and I'm all the way up here. And you know, so in that sense, you get to indulge your kind of ego and your sort of notion of being in love with yourself. On the other hand, you look around and you say to yourself, look how small I am. Look how beautiful and big the world is. And your ego sort of gets peeled away from under you, you know. And that ultimately, I think, for people is the real appeal of climbing, the opportunity to engage in the way life is. And when you do that, you find out you're very small in a very big universe. And that actually is, paradoxically, it's kind of liberating.
Ego pulled away, though, as you remind us, and as your quote reminds us, all the way to oblivion. I mean, kind of death itself. Is there a death wish in here? You also quote Goethe saying, "Over all the mountains is peace. Only wait. Soon you too shall find rest." But these climbers are going up, knowing that that may be their destination on a climb.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, I think part of the appeal of climbing and some other activities is that we all know in the back of our minds that we're going to die someday, and we have to find peace with that. We have to find comfort in a world where everything changes, we lose everything. Climbers, I think, engage that question directly, at least some of us. And when you do that, you find that you're okay with that condition ultimately, or at least there's the possibility of finding out that you're okay. I think a lot of these guys, a lot of the men in my story, were guys who were battering their heads against something they didn't quite understand, a certain frustration, which I think is part of our condition as human beings. Yeah, go, please.
Well, you quote Robert Reed, Mountains of the Great Blue Dream, writing, "In the curious playgrounds of their sport, mountaineers learn what primitive people knew instinctively, that mountains are the abode of the dead, and that to travel in the high country is not simply to risk death, but to risk understanding it." Clint Willis, we want to hear more about the generation you're writing about in The Boys of Everest, but a lot of listeners want to join this conversation as well. Let me go to Guido in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Hi, Guido. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I want to bring a slightly different dimension into this. people have been very eloquent as to why people climb and pushing themselves, pushing to the ultimate. But I have another concern, and that is that I belong to a club called the Mazamas in Portland, Oregon. I don't live in the Northwest. I live in the East, but I have climbed the Cooper Spur route on Mount Hood. If that's the route that these people were on, it is an extremely steep route with a lot of avalanche danger, I would presume, at the top. My question is, I was told that the possibility of very extreme weather had been well publicized in the Northwest. And somebody told me that these climbers were aware of that and decided to, quote, beat the storm, unquote, to get to the top.
And race up, race down, and beat the blizzards.
Beat the blizzard. And to me, that is unacceptable as a mountaineering ethic. I believe that most experienced climbers would not knowingly do that. And I just wanted to find out whether, in fact, that is true, whether they knew in advance or had reason to know in advance about these conditions, because I think that's a part of mountaineering that I personally, as a very incidentally intermediate mountaineer, if you will, have concerns about. So that's really what's on my mind.
There's the risk factor raised by someone who knows this mountain and maybe this path, at least the Cooper Spur ridge route up. Clint Willis, I don't know how closely you've looked at this and their preparation. I mean, the reports that have come out say when they found Kelly James and his camera and looked at the photos on it, the search and rescue team said these guys were incredibly well-equipped, but only for a quick race up and down, not for a time of tough weather. Guido says, what about it? Was this an unacceptable level of risk? How do climbers determine that?
Yeah, no, well, it's always an issue. I mean, I think in mountaineering, one of the appeals of mountaineering is that you're always making judgments of that sort. Do I go forward despite the weather forecast? What do I bring with me? And the whole issue of what you bring with you is actually at the heart of extreme mountaineering. I mean, over the years, one of the things that Bonington and his gang did was they began to strip down their expeditions from the old siege-style trip where you'd go lay siege to a mountain with huge porter, you know, huge teams of porters and an army of them, really, and a series of camps and oxygen. Eventually, these guys were running up these huge ridges with three or four old friends and carrying everything on their back and taking, you know, much, much greater risks. It changed the nature of the endeavor when they took those risks. It allowed them to do things they couldn't otherwise have done. I think for climbers today, you know, there is a very lightweight ethic among extreme climbers where you just move up fast and light and get down fast. And the idea is that by doing that, often you actually reduce some risks while taking on others. In this case, I just don't have the facts. You know, I think when you're not on the scene, it's really tough to make judgments about whether someone, you know, behaved, behaved unethically or you know, in mountaineering ethics terms, I mean.
Yeah.
Or whether they simply made a judgment that proved to be wrong. I mean, it does happen.
The sheriff there saying, you know, these guys had knowledge, they had the equipment, it just wasn't enough for this weather. I want to understand this shift in risk-taking that you alluded to there. You began the book, The Boys of Everest, going all the way back kind of May 29th, 1953, famously, Tenzing Norgay and Edmund Hillary on top of Mount Everest. And as you describe it, that as the kind of triumph of an era where it was almost a kind of martial assault with lots and lots of people in support and going up very carefully. You write that the history of mountaineering at that moment appeared to be over, but it wasn't. Chris Bonington, who you write about in the gang that came with him, these were not gentlemen climbers. They had a different ethic. What was that ethic, and is it still the presiding one today?
Yeah, that ethic took shape over time for them. You know, these were guys who came out of the working class and the middle class of England, and they were the earliest climbers from that culture to come from those classes. And so they went about it differently. They weren't as into hierarchy. They weren't into authority. You know, a lot of this took place in the 60s when people were questioning those kinds of things anyway. And after World War II in England, the social class barriers were beginning to break down. So people were able to begin to forge their identity as individuals, and climbing was an ideal way for these guys to do it. In terms of risk, you know, they just kept raising the bar in terms of what they wanted to do. They started out with these great big snow peaks, you know, kind of plodding up them. And then they decided they could go up the really huge walls and the big long ridges at high altitude. And then eventually they decided they could do it with smaller teams. It was more fun and it felt to them like more sport. You know, there was the phrase, the murder of the impossible. that Reinhold Messner, the great Tyrolean climber, applied to some of the bigger expeditions in the 70s that were laying siege to the big walls on Everest and elsewhere. And these guys participated in that, Bonington and his men. They did it, and they took that kind of expedition to its extreme iteration, and then they decided, all right, what next? And what was next was, let's make it harder. Let's go up just a few of us. And that turned out to be more fun, too, and that was a big part of it.
You write about the climbers in this circle of British climbers who went up and up, a decided tendency to press on, to cross the avalanche-prone snow slope, to climb higher as daylight waned or a storm blew in. They took extreme risks when their luck held. They pushed it still further. Their acceptance of such risks created new possibilities, but you quote or get the view of the old school climbers like George Mallory, British climber here, that these kind of risks were, well, he saw these guys as daredevils, irresponsible, actually unsporting. So whose view of climbing reigns today, the old school or is it still the daredevil school?
I think it's the latter. You know, people are much more comfortable with some of the perceived risks these guys were taking. You know, the other thing is there was a debate about whether it would be safer to go up with small teams or if, because when you had a large team, you were on the mountain for longer, going back and forth over avalanche slopes and things like that. You were there longer, you might get caught in the storm. I mean, there is no safety in those mountains. I think that's the fact that has to be faced.
But it does depend in some degree on how you do it. Let me take a call from Salt Lake City, Utah, and Stephen. Hi, Stephen, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Hello, sir. Yes.
Reading the news reports, and of course I guess these are questions that are never going to get answered, but the thing that seems so odd in this whole saga is that these guys knew where they were. They were close to the top of the mountain, presumably. They had a snow cave. Maybe they dug it, maybe they found it, but there was plenty of shelter in a snow cave. Presumably they had a stove or some way to melt a little bit of water, and they had a cell phone. Why wouldn't, in those conditions, you just sit? Why would these guys even try to go down in those kinds of conditions? They knew there was going to be a rescue because one individual was apparently injured, and they would have had to have been a helicopter up there eventually. Maybe not for quite a while, but something doesn't ring right about what happened. Maybe we'll never know, but I'd certainly value a comment on it.
There were eventually helicopters and planes and people all over there, but why didn't they just sit? For an answer to that, Stephen, let us get closer to Mount Hood. We've got a couple of terrific world-class climbers with us from Kirkland, Washington. We're joined by Phil and Sue Erschler, professional climbers, expedition guides. They're the first couple, I think, on the planet, married couple, to together scale all the seven summits, the highest peak on each of seven continents, including Mount Everest. They know the Northwest well. Phil Erschler, Sue Erschler, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
Hi, Phil. Hi, Sue. Hi, thanks for being here. Stephen's calling from Salt Lake City and asking, just to begin with, a very practical question. They had a cell phone. They had some gear. Why do you imagine they didn't just sit tight in their snow cave?
Steve, this is Phil. I guide a lot on Mount Rainier with our company, International Mountain Guides. We have a fair amount of experience in those kinds of mountains. The short answer is we'll never know, but you can imagine the scenario with those men. The storm was so bad that it took out power to literally a million people in the Northwest. And at that point, they're thinking, how long can I hold on? We don't know how much fuel they had exactly, what the extent of injuries may or may not have been, things that will be difficult for us to know. But it's easy for me to envision as a human being and also as a climber that at some point, I think, it's now or never. Maybe there was a little break in the weather. Maybe they had that feeling that, yes, I do know the way out of here, and this is our best shot, particularly if the one climber was injured and they felt that we're going to lose our partner. Also consider the state of hypothermia that these gentlemen were eventually slipping into, where decision-making becomes more difficult.
Sue Erschler, take us into the kind of emergency snow cave that these men would have built on Mount Hood. How do you place one? How do you build it? What's required of it? How long can humans survive in a snow cave?
And I have only seen a snow cave. I think I would rather defer that question to Phil because he's been much more familiar with them.
Sure. Phil?
You know, Tom, Sue was a non-climber when I met her 10 years ago, and she went from 0 to 60 in a short period of time. She is not a professional climber. She is a professional person who thoroughly enjoys the mountains. A snow cave like that, again, the guys, they were able to get that snow cave in those kinds of conditions. I think they deserve a lot of credit. They did the right thing. They tried to get shelter. Shelter was their first, foremost, immediate concern with that kind of wind and temperature. They needed to get out of that wind. I remember climbing Mount McKinley the first time in 1976 for me with a great Northwest climber named Jim Wickwire. And we were young rookie climbers, and Jim, experienced hand, and Jim told us, you know, no matter what, you make sure you have with you a stove and a shovel. Those are the two things that will help you survive if you get into trouble on Mount McKinley.
Clint, I wish you'd read us just a little bit from the book. You've got one of these moments that may help explain it here with a couple guys up very high. Set it up for us and give us a reading on where they are, who they are, and where we find them when your text begins here.
Sure. I think you're exactly right. Really, moments are what explain something like climbing, what you find in the moments of your life in the mountains. This is 1963. Chris Bonington and Don Willens are climbing on the Central Tower of Pain, which is a very steep climb in Patagonia where the weather is just terrible. And they've been sitting around for weeks waiting for the weather to give them a chance at climbing this thing. They'll go up for a bit, fix some rope, get blown off by the wind. And finally, they've gotten a day where they think they can climb it. So here we go. Mm. They came to a gap in the ridge and rappelled onto the face below it. They moved across snow, past the gap, and then climbed back onto the crest and climbed another pillar as light bled from the sky. This metamorphosis bathed them in beauty, but they were unaware of it. They moved still more quickly now, intent upon their goal. They climbed two more pillars, and then Don led across a short wall to disappear around a corner. He shouted, and Chris followed to find his friend sitting on a block the size of a table. There was nothing else to climb. Night drifted up at them like smoke from some enormous distant fire. Each man considered the possibility that he had stumbled into a trap, that some force had arranged things to puzzle him and draw him onward. It was possible. They had come here to satisfy their curiosity, and in doing so had uncovered precise and secret patterns. The patterns blurred and faded into mystery, even now. Fear and grief leaked into the enterprise. The sun had sunk almost into the ice cap. There was still, by what seemed a miracle, daylight. They looked upon glaciers and peaks that seemed new to the world. They knew there was nowhere to keep this. It would never again be as real to them. Even now, their awareness sputtered and lapsed between moments of astonishment. The wind had dropped entirely away. It was as if the wind had died in a literal sense, as if the wind would not return. All around them was the peace they had sought, without knowing they sought it.
Clint Willis, reading there from his new book, The Boys of Everest. There's a high on Everest in 1963, and you can feel the romance right there. Listeners, do you share it? Have you known it? Michael's calling from Hartford, Connecticut. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
We're well. What do you hear? What do you see, Michael?
I'm a climber and a writer in Hartford, and I'm curious as to whether any of your guests think that the new technologies that people are carrying into the mountains, the climbers on Mount Hood, as we know, went very light, but they did carry something that most climbers didn't used to take, which is a cell phone. And I'm curious as to whether they think cell phones and GPS and the possibility of carrying transponders into the mountains are pushing people to take risks they might not otherwise take.
It's a great question. Sue Ursula, let me put it to you. Lots of equipment out there, including cell phones on this one. Do you see the technology itself pushing climbers into new levels of risk?
Right. And because I do live with a guide and we've climbed together our entire time, cell phones are great. GPSs are great. But I know that the battery has to work. They have to be functional. So I think that can be a concern. They're tremendous. I've used a GPS to come down from Rainier in a complete whiteout and takes you right to the parking lot. But what if the battery didn't work? So having backup is always great, and keeping batteries charged, especially like on Everest, is a problem as well.
So what about the motivation piece here? Phil's been climbing, it seems like, all his life. You came to it much more recently and have climbed like crazy. Now one of the world's most accomplished women climbers. What motivates you? What takes you up there, and do you feel crazy sometimes on the, you know, on a sheer face?
Yes, I do feel crazy sometimes. I started climbing at age 36, and I have always worked for a corporation, so I met Phil, and Phil took me up Rainier, and I felt sick to my stomach in the middle of the night, found myself up there climbing. But when we reached the top, that sense of accomplishment for me was unmatched by anything I'd ever done. So I was hooked, and within the next 10 years, we just started climbing the seven summits, the highest mountain on each continent, while I was on vacation. And then that led us to Everest. But I guess what I would like to say is that there is risk, and I had to deal with that. And especially on Everest, there's risk. But for me, we managed the risk, that's for sure. But also, I'm quite scared up there, especially on that mountain. And I don't think complacency could set in for me. That's one thing that I always watched, because to be a little bit fearful keeps you safe. I would double clip, I'd double check that clip, everything about the climb. But then again, you know, reaching the top and to do that with Phil and to stand there, I've never had such a feeling of contentment in my life. And I'd never give that up. And so we managed the risk. We were as careful as can be, as conservative. We'd turn around in a heartbeat. We did it in 2001, 1,400 feet from the summit. We'd do it again.
The romance is right there. Let's go to Tripoli, Iowa. That's flatland. Rod's on the line. Hi, Rod. You're on the air.
Yes. Thank you, Tom.
Sure.
Yeah, I was just curious who pays for these deals?
Who pays for the expeditions or the rescue or what, Rod?
No, the rescue. The rescue. Who pays for the rescue?
And why do you ask?
Well, I'm just curious because I assume it's us, the taxpayers.
I've got a note here saying a few months ago an ambulance came for you when you had a medical problem. It cost you $7,500.
Yes, that's correct.
So you're saying if I'm paying $7,000 plus to be picked up with a medical problem, what about the National Guard out in Oregon for climbers? Phil, what about it?
No question. It's a issue that should continue to be addressed. But keep in mind, this is not just a function of mountain climbers that sometimes get into trouble. We have planes that go down, private aviation. We have boaters who get lost or get into trouble in weather. And so it's a question that needs to be addressed more broadly than just mountaineers. And Europe has a great insurance system for climbers, and it's something that perhaps Americans need to spend a little more time looking at additionally.
I see. Most states, the costs go to the government, not to the climbers. A few it can go to the climber. I think in Oregon it's a $500 limit, and I'm sure this cost more than that. Clint Willis, are climbers sort of loading the risk, cost risk side of their romance with the mountain off on the rest of humanity? Is it worth it? Do they somehow take us somewhere, even when we have to pay for their trouble?
You know, I think that there is an element of that going on here. I mean, the three guys who went up on Hood, everything I've read about them suggests that they were wonderful guys. They had a lot of love for life and brought that to their communities and their families and their work. And that stuff can get spread around in ways that nobody can quantify. I think people pursuing what they love and occasionally getting into trouble, well, if the rest of the community needs to help bail them out, I don't necessarily think that's a bad deal for the community. Then again, I understand that there are other things that go on in people's lives where they could use some help and they don't get it. So that's another issue we should look at as well.
Janet's calling from Boston. Hi, Janet. You're on the air.
I'm sitting here getting very frustrated. I have two questions for the climbers. One, I hear a lot of personal risk assessment. Is there an assessment about the people you might leave behind who don't want anything to do with this personal adventure? And the point, too, is that I have two brothers who are firemen. So I'm very frustrated with people who incur this kind of risk and don't think about the people who are stupid enough to go up after them. They're crazy. They'd do it. And do you think about the ramifications, not for yourself? If you want to climb a mountain and kill yourself, that's your business, but you are potentially taking people with you. And I find that extremely frustrating.
Sue Ursler, what do you say to Janet?
Yeah, no, I think it's a very valid point. I know that when we were on Everest, my parents are here in Seattle. I have three brothers, and it is tough on families because sometimes they don't hear from you, even though you might have a satellite phone and such. In Phil's and my case, we did have to assess that, and we're married. We were together, and we don't have children. I don't know if that would have impacted the decision, but what I can tell you is we don't. And that was an element that was something that we thought about. We're together on this mountain. We're going to take, again, you're also, though, managing your risks. You're not out there. I do not see it as a daredevil sport.
And, Phil, what about Janet has brothers who are firefighters, the kind of people who, you know, in slightly different capacities might be headed up to try and bail out a climber in trouble. She's not so happy about them being dragged up, though. You know, no one wants to leave someone on a peak. But you see the cost she's pointing to.
I do. I have spent more than a day in the mountains on rescues in my career as a guide. But it would be I think we'd have a less world if human beings ceased to endeavor to stop at the status quo, to not go out and explore, experiment, and push the limits. I think that's a big part of what makes the human race.
Let me go to Kyle in Clifton, Virginia. Hi, Kyle, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just had a comment. I'd like your guest's response to it. There's been psychological testing, baseline profiling of people who are inclined to mountain climbing or other similar activities. I'm a climber for more than 30 years. And some of it suggests that those types frequently are low on the chemicals in the natural balance of the brain, which give a feeling of exhilaration or positive active affirmation, and that in doing something like climbing, that stimulates a production of those chemicals and restores maybe something closer to a natural healthy balance in the brain. Like people's thoughts on that.
So for some people, maybe it takes the peak of Everest to get their chemical well-being in balance. Clint Willis, how about it? Do you see a profile in the daredevil generation you looked at? Do they seem to need 29,000 feet to feel exhilaration?
Yeah, I'm sort of sitting here nodding my head. You know, I think that's true of a lot of the climbers. I know personally it's true to some degree of some of the guys I interviewed for the book who were in the book, and it certainly was true for some of the guys who die in the course of the story of the Boys of Everest. You know, Dougal Heston, who was a very famous figure among this crowd, was a guy who obviously had emotional issues. He had problems with alcohol. He had actually killed a guy accidentally, you know, while driving drunk, killed a young man. And he was fighting real demons. So was Don Willens and some of the other guys, too. So there is an element of that that rings a bell for me. I'm not saying it's true of all climbers, but it definitely gets you going, even if you're the type that has a hard time getting going, you know, in a happy place. Yeah, it brings a lot of happiness. But I want to jump in with one comment about the loss issue, you know, that the woman previously raised.
Mm-hmm.
In writing this story, you know, I tried to get into the heads of these climbers and their experience as much as I could. And then in speaking to them, I had a lot of help doing that. And I spoke to survivors of the climbers who die in the course of the story. And there are a lot of them. Climbers, I mean, who die. Mm-hmm. And the survivors are still scarred by things that happened 30 and 40 years ago. The level of pain that these losses cause, not just to the, you know, the climbers are losing their lives. I mean, and they're losing all the wonderful things that probably lay ahead for these guys, especially because they were talented, you know, guys who knew how to make an interesting life for themselves. But their families, too, and their friends, the pain from these losses that happened decades ago is still ongoing. And it's almost like it grows over time. It expands in this web that includes other people. Just as these guys on Hood, there are people around the country who feel great sadness for their loss. I mean, and it's something that has to be faced. It really has to be faced when you're thinking about this. That doesn't mean you don't go climbing, but it means you go climbing with an understanding of what's at stake.
Nobody climbs alone. Let me get one more call here from Canton, New York. Baylor's on the line. Hi, Baylor. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you, Tom?
We're well.
I just wanted to comment a little bit on what I see as the motivations for climbing. I think there are many, and they differ from person to person.
Mm-hmm.
But one is that, picking up on the comment earlier about death and oblivion, you know, if oblivion being sort of that sense of everything bigger than you and you're tiny, if you feel that in a crowd of people, it sort of attacks your self-respect. But if you feel it in the face of the universe, it makes the crowd itself seem small and unimportant. And that's a wonderful feeling, really, to see yourself as part of something much, much bigger than ordinary everyday cares and woes.
and the kind of singularity of it, that there is something, despite the teams that go up, so we're hearing something about the self at the summit that is celebrated, even in the face of that vast universe you look up to. Phil, the self-centered piece of this, does it take everybody with it at some level? Are you sure? Or is it all about an individual's kind of explosion into the universe from that peak? And is that fine by you?
I don't think it's just strictly that selfish an activity. I think as individuals, we do this most often as a team. We're not solo climbing. We're part of a team. We're part of a bigger whole. We go up and we learn. We learn a lot about ourselves, what we value, what we respect in ourselves, what we learn to appreciate and value in others. There's a great quote from a guy named René Dumas who said something along the lines of, there is an art to conducting oneself in the lower regions by what one has learned higher up. When one can no longer see, one can still know. We live, we love at sea level, but we take what we learn in the mountains, what we learn to value and respect and appreciate, and we bring that down and apply it to our lives at sea level.
And there is the mountaineer's view. Phil and Sue Ursler with International Mountain Guides, joining us today from Kirkland, Washington, climbed all the seven summits, the seven tallest peaks on each continent. Thank you very much for being with us today. We appreciate your perspective, Sue and Phil. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Clint Willis, author of The Boys of Everest, Chris Bonington, and The Tragedy of Climbing's Greatest Generation. Thanks for the insight today, Mr. Willis. Thank you very much for the book and for your time.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can probably even get it on a mountaintop. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.